From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. And we're getting our first public look into the historic impeachment inquiry. Democrats have accused President Trump of abusing his power by asking Ukraine to investigate his political rival while holding up foreign aid to that country. NPR's diplomatic correspondent Michelle Kellerman joins us now from the State Department. Hi, Michelle.
Hi there, Tanya.
Well, one of the big revelations so far today has come from William Taylor, the top U.S. diplomat in Ukraine. The chair of the Intelligence Committee, Democrat Adam Schiff, asked Taylor about a phone conversation Taylor's aide overheard after the July 25th phone call. Let's listen.
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Taylor, I'd like to begin by following up on something that you have disclosed today and you disclosed earlier to both majority and minority, but it is some new information for the committee. You said in your testimony that one of your staff was present with Ambassador Sondland on the day after the July 25th phone call. Is that right?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
And as your staff related the event to you, your staff member could overhear Mr. Sondland on the phone. We could overhear the president on the phone with Mr. Sondland. Is that right?
That's correct.
So the president must have been speaking loud enough on the phone. This was a cell phone, I take it?
It was a cell phone.
The president must have been speaking loud enough for your staff member to be able to overhear this?
It was.
And what your staff member could overhear was President Trump asking Ambassador Sondland about, quote, the investigations. Is that right?
That's correct.
Now, I think you testified also that you had come to understand that the term investigations was a term that Ambassador Sondland, as well as Volker, used to mean matters related to the 2016 elections and to the investigations of Burisma and the Bidens. Is that correct?
That is correct, Mr. Chairman.
So your staff member overhears the president asking about the investigations, meaning Burisma and the Bidens in 2016. And Ambassador Sondland told President Trump that the Ukrainians were ready to move forward?
He did.
And I think you said that after the call, when your staff asked Ambassador Sondland what President Trump thought of Ukraine, his response was that President Trump cares more about the investigations of Biden. Is that right?
And Burisma, yes, sir.
Michelle, you've spoken with an attorney for Ambassador Sondland about that phone call. What did that lawyer tell you about the significance of it?
Well, he wouldn't comment on this now, but Ambassador Sondland will be addressing that in his public testimony next week. And let's just remind listeners who Ambassador Sondland is. He's the U.S. ambassador to the European Union. He's a political appointee and a donor to President Trump. And he, during all of this time, had kind of an inroad on what they're calling an irregular channel between President Trump and Ukraine.
I want to also listen in on something else William Taylor said. He described learning that security assistance and a White House meeting with the president were both conditioned on Ukraine carrying out investigations that President Trump wanted.
On that same day, September 1st, I sent Ambassador Sondland a text message asking if we are now saying that the security assistance and a White House meeting are conditioned on investigations. Ambassador Sondland responded, asking me to call him, which I did. During that phone call, Ambassador Sondland told me that President Trump had told him that he wants President Zelensky to state publicly that Ukraine will investigate Burisma and alleged Ukrainian interference in the 2016 election. Ambassador Sondland also told me that he now recognized that he had made a mistake by earlier telling Ukrainian officials that only a White House meeting with President Zelensky was dependent on a public announcement of the investigations. In fact, Ambassador Sondland said, everything was dependent on such an announcement, including security assistance. He said that President Trump wanted President Zelensky in a public box by making a public statement about ordering such investigations.
Michelle, we've been hearing a lot of details. What else has jumped out to you about William Taylor's testimony?
Well, I think in general, Bill Taylor, who had been an ambassador to Ukraine before, gave a very strong opening argument about why it is important to support Ukraine in the face of Russian aggression, why it is in the U.S. national security interests, and why he took the job, because that's what he thought he was going to be doing. He describes how he was part of the normal business dealings between the U.S. and Ukraine, but that there was this irregular channel that was more focused on, as you heard him there saying, putting Ukraine's new president in a box to publicly call for these investigations that could help President Trump politically. So that was kind of the overarching argument that he was making. And, you know, he said, look, it's important to have a meeting with the White House. It's not just a matter of you know, niceties. It was important for the new president to have a meeting with the White House because he wanted to be in a stronger position to negotiate with Russia to get Russian troops out of Ukraine.
Michelle, what about what the Republicans are doing today? Let's listen here to Devin Nunes, who is the ranking member on the Intelligence Committee. This is what he said in his opening statement.
What we will witness today is a televised theatrical performance staged by the Democrats. Ambassador Taylor and Mr. Kent, I'd like to welcome you here. I'd like to congratulate you for passing the Democrat Star Chamber auditions held for the last weeks in the basement of the Capitol. It seems you agreed, witting or unwittingly, to participate in a drama. But the main performance, the Russia hoax, has ended, and you've been cast in the low-rent Ukrainian sequel. I'll conclude by noting the immense damage the politicized bureaucracy has done to Americans' faith in government. Though executive branch employees are charged with implementing the policies set by our president, who is elected and responsible to the American people, elements of the civil service have decided that they, not the president, are really in charge.
So it sounds like Republicans are continuing on the theme of saying the process is unfair, this is partisan, and not addressing the substance of some of these allegations? Or what are your thoughts on that?
Well, yeah, and this attack, the calling it a politicized bureaucracy was quite striking because the two men who are appearing today are career public servants. You know, Bill Taylor was a Vietnam War veteran. George Kent has been a foreign service officer for nearly three decades, working for both Democrats and Republicans. And by the way, they also were talking about how Trump's policy was a good one, and that was to support Ukraine with, you know, including with defensive weapons. It was the irregular channel that they're raising concerns about. There is another part that Nunes talked about. He says that the U.S. is trying to impeach this president for inquiring about Hunter Biden's activities. And that was another interesting aspect of this, because let's remember that Biden's son was on the board of an energy company with a long history of corruption. George Kent actually told the committee that he raised concerns when he first heard that Vice President Biden's son was on the board of Burisma. He said there was a perception of a conflict of interest, but he also said that since then he did not witness any efforts by any U.S. official to shield Burisma from scrutiny. The question really is whether it's appropriate for the president to be asking Ukraine to investigate something for political reasons, or an American citizen specifically, because that's what Kent said. It's that when you're asking countries to engage in selective, politically associated investigations, that undermines the rule of law.
President Trump, meanwhile, as this is all going on, has been meeting with the president of Turkey, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, who is in Washington for a visit. They're going to hold a press conference later today. We remember that just recently, Erdogan took Turkish troops into Syria, apparently with the president's blessing, to take control from the U.S. allies, the Kurds there. The president says he's not watching what's going on. We're not sure whether that is the case or not. But what do you expect to hear from the president and from Erdogan when they're asked about this at a press conference later?
Well, the president has also been downplaying everything that's come out in these details. He just says, look at the call, meaning the partial transcript of his July call with Ukraine's new president. He called it perfect, and he's been dismissing all of these other stories, as the Republicans have, saying these are secondhand, third-hand stories. These aren't people that have been with him directly. Now, the committees have asked have asked for testimony from White House officials who have met directly with Trump, and they've been blocking that.
Mm. Long day ahead. We will continue to hear lots of testimony. What else will you be listening for as we move forward?
Well, we're also going to be hearing later this week from Marie Yovanovitch. She was the ambassador to Ukraine who was ousted after a smear campaign against her led by Rudy Giuliani. That's President Trump's private lawyer.
Private lawyer.
So we'll be hearing a lot more from her about that and about how career public servants are being treated by this administration.
That's NPR's diplomatic correspondent, Michelle Kellerman. Michelle, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Our next guest is perhaps the world's most well-known Finnish comedian. His name is Ismo, and a video of his January 2018 appearance on Conan O'Brien's show has been seen over 70 million times on Facebook. Much of his comedy is about the English language and differences he's noticed between Finland and America.
I like driving here more than I did in Finland, because here the law is different, because here you can take a right on the red light. I love that. In Finland, that's illegal, so I feel like a criminal. I'm just always taking rights way more than I should. If the light is red, I'm gonna take a right. I basically go in circles. I love it so much.
We spoke with Ismo in July of last year. He was in the UK preparing to appear at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. Ismo, welcome to Here and Now.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Well, and great. I'm calling you Ismo, by the way. Like, you do have a last name, but you go by just Ismo, like Cher or Madonna or something like that.
Yeah, that's true. I don't think there's many Ismos in America or maybe in the world of comedy in general. So I thought that it's easier to just have my first name. And yeah, it's nice. Four letters, like Cher.
Like Cher, right. And you're from Finland, which you talk about a lot in your comedy. I can't think of another comedian who's made it big who's from Finland. Can you?
Well, at least outside of Finland, I can't.
Well, why did you want to do that? Why did you want to take your comedy around the world?
Well, at first it was just, I really wanted to see, can I translate it and does it work in English? And it was just like I had nothing to lose. Like more than 10 years ago, I went to London actually to do my first English gigs and I just wanted to try it out. And then it was so promising and I kept going back and then suddenly, now I'm doing way more English than Finnish, so it paid off.
But you do comedy also in Finnish?
Yeah. Yeah, when I go to Finland, I do it in Finnish, yeah.
Is it very different?
Well, yes and no. Like some jokes are, like, or some things I tell are completely, it doesn't matter which language, if it's a story or something, like an observation. But then I do play a lot with the language, and that's mostly untranslatable. But actually, I think when I try to translate something untranslatable, I come up with new jokes. So it's good to think in two languages.
Well, let's listen to a little bit for people who haven't heard you of some of the comedy that you do that does involve the English language. Here you are talking about what's up.
But I have to say that it took a long time to learn the things, like the small, subtle things. Like it took me a year to figure out that the correct answer to what's up is what's up.
How did you identify that as something that was weird? Because it's true, we say it all the time, nobody thinks about it.
Yeah, I think, like, I heard it a lot after moving to America, and it's weird because in Finland, if we ask a question, it's almost always like you have to answer something. Like when we just walk by somebody, we just say hi. But if we ask something, then we actually, like, are expecting an answer, but what's up is completely the opposite. What's up is just like, I remember the old commercials where people were just shouting that, what's up?
Right, right.
Nobody was answering.
I mean, you could say the same thing almost about how are you. You could say, how are you? How are you?
Yeah, I've been trying to get this right because it's been so, that has been the most difficult part actually about moving to America is the small talk rules. Because like my theory is that when somebody says, how are you? You have to say, good. How are you? Like, you have to kind of answer a little bit. But with what's up, it's just what's up, what's up. So that's my theory. But people do it differently. Everybody does it. Like, so it's those small talk things. And like, how you doing? That's even, like, you never answer anything to that.
One of your most famous bits involves the word, and I'll just give people a warning if they've got kids in the car or something like that. They might be annoyed by me using this phrase, but ass. You talk a lot about ass.
Sometimes if you add ass to something, it can actually reverse the meaning of the original word. Like, for example, bad ass. That's good. Like, bad is bad, but bad ass is good. But not always. Like, dumb ass is still dumb.
And you go on about this. You've got a lot of observations on the word ass.
Oh yeah, it's like a 4 or 5 minute routine about just the word ass. And now sometimes people even stop me on the street and say that, hey, it's the ass guy. The whole thing started when I kind of tried to figure out what ass means, and I realized that sometimes it doesn't mean anything. It's just like optional, like a long ass flight. It's the same flight without the ass. It's just a long flight. And my favorite, a grown ass man. It's a grown man, which was like, it, to me, it sounded like it's just the ass that has grown, but it's the whole man. So.
Do you use those phrases, by the way, that you've discovered and find so crazy that we use them? I mean, do you use them in when you're speaking English?
Well, yeah, I try to use them, but I'm kind of amused. Like, it's really hard for me to say that, oh, it was a long-ass flight. Like, without thinking that it's just weird to say. It's just, I'm too self-conscious of the word to kind of use it normally. But I try to use it. And the whole thing was like, I was just trying to figure out the English language and try to learn it. But then I stumbled into many jokes while trying to learn it. And I keep doing that all the time.
What you do kind of reminds me a bit of a routine that George Carlin did, the late George Carlin did a long time ago about sort of weird phrases in the English language. And I went back and I found one of the moments I'm talking about. I just want to play it for you. Here he is.
Down the tubes. Hear that one a lot. People say, the country is going down the tubes. What tubes? Have you seen any tubes? Where are these tubes? And where do they go? And how come there's more than one tube?
So there he is. And he talks about take the cake and some of these other ridiculous phrases that we use. But I mean, I wonder whether you got any inspiration from other comedians who have talked about these kinds of things.
Well I've heard the comparison to George Carlin a few times, and it's been great because I really love his stuff. Yeah. I have listened to all his stuff years ago. And I definitely like the style of like analyzing the language and doing long lists. I remember when I read a book about how to do comedy, and the first rule was don't do lists. And then I said, screw that, I'm doing lists, and Carlin also does lists. So I love that. But yeah, definitely I've got inspiration. I think from him, like I listened to him years and years ago, but then lately sometimes I go back to it also. So. I do listen to a lot of comedy, and now it's all over Netflix and everything, so you can get comedy anywhere.
So where do you see your career going now?
Well, I really enjoy living in America, and the comedy scene is so great. Because like after doing Conan, I've been touring a lot inside the States and Canada and Australia and New Zealand. And yeah, I'm just happy to tour a lot. And of course, a special is, I think that's kind of the obvious next step I'm hoping to do is to do a comedy special. And yeah, I try to not make any rigid plans. I'm like, I never had plans when I started to do comedy. I didn't even know that you can make a living doing comedy when I started. It was just a fun thing to do. And then suddenly that was my job a few years later.
Do you worry at all about losing your sort of sense of being an outsider if you now live in Los Angeles as opposed to Finland?
definitely not, because I think I've always felt kind of an outsider of the whole human race. So, yeah, I'm just happy to learn better English, and my jokes will be more subtle, I guess, in the future if I do more language stuff. Mm-hmm. And of course, I do lots of other stuff also. Yeah.
You ever do political comedy?
Not really. I don't follow it enough, and there's so many comedians doing that now.
Right.
So I do like exploring society and human behavior, but like a bigger scale than like day-to-day politics.
I was just asking you because, of course, the world's eyes were just on Finland, you know, in the last few weeks because of the Helsinki summit between Trump and Putin.
Oh, yeah. And actually, and that was a funny coincidence, I was there in Helsinki.
Uh-huh.
My main worry was that the world was watching Helsinki in a heat wave. So now people have like a hugely misunderstood the Finnish weather.
Okay. You know, there's one phrase that we don't say in the United States, but they do say where you are in the United Kingdom. They say they're going to hospital as opposed to going to the hospital. I've never understood that. My father's English. I don't understand why they take the out before they say hospital.
Yeah, that is weird. It's kind of like like it would be like a continuous substance. The hot, like I'm having milk, like
right.
Not,
well,
not
I guess you'd say
milk.
You'd say I'm going to school in the U.S. You wouldn't say I'm going to the school, but you would never say I'm going to hospital here.
Hey, that's true. Because like going to school means like, that means that you are going there for years, but going
right.
to hospital, hopefully, it's just like
just
one
for an hour.
Busy.
Right.
Yeah. This is a kind of a fun thing I just noticed because I'm now in the UK. Is that like in? It's a little bit of a difference between America and UK. Is that like it's the highest honor in the UK to be called a sir. Like that's mm-hmm. that's the, like the highest thing you can get is like being a sir. But in America, being called a sir means that you have kind of made a small mistake. Like, sir, you have to wait behind the yellow line, sir.
That's right. You're not really Sir Paul McCartney when that happens.
Yeah, it's like, sir, you have to pay for that. It's like you
excuse me,
wrong.
Sir. Right?
Yeah, it's kind of slightly a bad thing.
That is the Finnish comedian Ismo. Thank you so much, and good luck to you.
Okay, thanks so much. Thanks for having me.
Have you been down the dairy aisle at your grocery store lately? I don't know about you, but there are so many choices, it's sometimes hard for me to find actual cow's milk. That's because Americans are increasingly choosing plant-based alternatives, and the dairy industry is feeling it. This week, Dallas-based Dean Foods, the nation's largest dairy retailer, filed for bankruptcy and is in talks to sell off the company. In a statement, Dean's fairly new president and CEO said it's been challenging to operate amid declines in milk consumption. Joining us now is Dom DeFurio. He's a business reporter for the Dallas Morning News. And Dom, how sharply has milk consumption actually declined here in the United States?
Yeah, so if you take a look at the USDA numbers, just in the last two decades, we've seen about a 26% decline in Americans' milk consumption, which is significant. And since 1975, over several decades, you can see that it's declined more than 40%. Mm. So these other types of drinks, like, you know, if you look at Nielsen data, oat milk's demand has skyrocketed in the last year.
Mm.
And a lot of people look at milk and they think, here's something I can cut from my diet. They're thinking differently about fluid milk. But demand for solid dairy products like butter and cheese consumption is actually still pretty strong. And unfortunately for Dean Foods, something like 60%+ of their sales last year came from that fluid milk category.
Mm.
So this is a company that has taken a lot of hits in the
yeah.
past couple of years.
I see that in filing for bankruptcy, they say that they are experiencing a shortage of drivers and trucks and rising labor costs and retailers also cutting back. The company is now in talks to sell to Dairy Farmers of America. Tell us more about what's being described as a co-op.
So the Dairy Farmers of America, it's farmer owned and run. And they came out and they did release a statement yesterday that said, yes, we have been in talks with Dean Foods. We've been eyeing them for a while. And based on what I've heard from bankruptcy experts, the bankruptcy filing could make this a more attractive transition. If the Dairy Farmers of America, for some reason, wants all of the assets, if they get that through the bankruptcy filing, you can kind of trim a lot of that debt and fat out of the company. And, yeah. and it could be a little bit easier of a transition.
Yeah. 60 to 70 dairy processing plants. So many people dependent on those jobs as a way of life for them. Some of the other conventional milk processors are actually getting in on the plant-based milk business. Reportedly, H.P. Hood, one of the oldest dairies, has a plant-based milk on the market, and the dairy cooperative Organic Valley has a series of offerings. Do you think we'll see more of this, traditional dairy farmers moving to plant-based beverage production?
I have not talked to any farmers about that, but I will say what farmers are facing right now is inflation in the cost of the product that they're producing. This is actually outlined in Deed Foods' latest supplemental SEC filings. And the other thing is they're supplying too much milk. And so at a certain point, there does have to be some sort of a reckoning as to, hey, the demand's just not there for this product anymore. And I think some farmers would be positioned to move into a category like plant-based beverages and things like that. It's possible.
Dom DeFurio covers business for the Dallas Morning News. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Tanya.
Southwest Airlines is facing scrutiny over 38 used planes it bought from companies like Russia and Turkey. According to the Federal Aviation Administration, Southwest has not been able to produce paperwork documenting previous repairs on those planes. For more, let's bring in Seth Kaplan, here in our transportation analyst. Hi, Seth.
Hi, Jeremy.
So Southwest is saying this is more of a record-keeping problem than a safety risk. Maybe not surprising that they would say that, but what's your sense? How worried should passengers be that Southwest can't produce these papers?
Well, the allegations are serious here. Southwest accused of not even translating the safety records into English. So I guess to, you know, misappropriate an old Donald Rumsfeld saying about how they're known unknowns and unknown unknowns, right? You know, the question is, are there just unknown unknowns here? And the reason I would, with hesitation, get on one of these planes is simply that these questionable repairs happened so long ago that these planes, by my math, have probably most of them been in the air 10,000 hours or so since then. And typically, you know, if you have something go very wrong, there's
It'll
not going to be
back
that
again,
less
right.
lag time before it happens. Yeah, but serious allegations nonetheless.
Well, and according to the Wall Street Journal, the FAA was thinking about grounding these planes, but decided not to. Why not?
Yeah, I'm looking at the memo here by the head auditor there, and you know the language is very unambiguous. It calls some of Southwest's claims, quote, nonsensical. So they were seriously considering this. The agreement was that Southwest would expedite inspecting all of these planes, that it'll all be done by January 31st. So you mentioned 38 planes, there were originally 88, something like half of them have already been inspected. Another handful of them are undergoing what's called heavy checks, where the plane is practically just taken apart and put back together on a routine basis every several years. And so, yeah, those other 38 by the end of January, and the FAA was satisfied with that agreement.
Okay, I want to ask you about another story. In the UK, there was a BBC TV program that involved fuel tankering, and it led to calls for an end to this practice. So first of all, what is fuel tankering?
Well, all airlines, when they fly, carry some extra fuel than it would normally take to get you to wherever you're flying. And of course, we want them to do this because if something goes wrong and you can't land in Chicago, you want them to have enough fuel to get to Milwaukee or even somewhere beyond that. What tankering is airlines carrying even extra fuel beyond what they could conceivably need because it's so much cheaper where they bought it that even though they have to carry the extra fuel and then that burns extra fuel, they still end up saving money. An extreme example, Jeremy, I remember one person at a non-U.S. airline once telling me that there was a route to Venezuela where fuel is heavily subsidized, very cheap, where the whole route was viable simply because of how cheap the fuel was there. Almost didn't matter how much the tickets cost. They bought the fuel there and then, you know, used it all day. That would be an extreme example, but that gives you an idea of what they're looking at here.
But you're saying that if they have to carry all that extra fuel on the journey, they're burning a lot more fuel on the plane just to carry that extra fuel.
That's right. And so that, Jeremy, is kind of different from usually what's good for airlines economically when it comes to fuel burn is also good for the environment, right? Because usually if you're saving fuel because you bought a new airplane, it burns less fuel, you're also emitting less carbon dioxide. But this is kind of an exception to that.
So do you think that airlines, including British Airways, are going to stop fuel tankering?
There's a there's a reasonable chance that they will, either because of all of this bad publicity or because they're forced to. I mean, these are, you know, public policy questions. You could have legislation, which some people are calling for in the UK. The allegation here is that British Airways, for example, was carrying around all kinds of extra fuel just to save something like $45 on one flight. And so that's where people are saying, if we're doing something really bad for the environment to save that, that's got to change.
That is Seth Kaplan, Here and Now transportation analyst, teaching us about a new term, fuel tankering. Now we know what that is. Seth, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Well, in these days of political division, New York theaters rarely present plays that explore the lives and thoughts of conservatives. But Heroes of the Fourth Turning is an exception. It's set at a reunion of graduates from a Catholic liberal arts college, and it has not only garnered rave reviews from the New York press, but also praise from conservative and religious publications. Jeff London reports.
Playwright Will Arbery grew up in a big Catholic family. He was the only boy with seven sisters. His father taught English literature and his mother political science at small Catholic colleges.
There would always be students in and out of the house, late night conversations, cigarettes, whiskey, wine, you know, just deep and passionate thought and disagreement and epiphany. All of these things were just the air I breathed when I was a kid.
Heroes of the Fourth Turning takes place in 2017, a week after the white supremacist rally and murder of Heather Heyer in Charlottesville. Four young characters and their older mentor struggle with their beliefs. They're all appalled by what happened in Charlottesville and some with the current administration. And they wonder if the divide between liberals and conservatives can be bridged.
That's something I've been thinking a lot about. Do we actually want to understand each other? Do we need this antagonism? Is this some sort of symbiotic relationship that feeds all of our sense of self? Yeah, it's definitely a question.
And the play is full of them. Jeb Krieger plays an ex-Marine.
One of my friends who came pretty early in previews said the scariest part about the play is how recognizable the absolutism is. I know people who are just like, if you voted for Trump, you're not a good person. If you work for Planned Parenthood, you're not a good person.
The debate over who can be a good person sparks an outburst from the character of Teresa after another asks her for a little more empathy.
Oh, don't with the empathy. Liberals are empathy addicts. Empathy, empathy, empathy. Empathy is empty.
But the characters aren't caricatures, says Zoe Winters, who plays Teresa.
This is a moment that I think Will has created, which isn't about justifying these views. It isn't about making you empathize with these views. It isn't about condemning them or defending them. It's just about showing us a different perspective than we are usually seeing on New York stages. And I think that that's important.
That uncritical presentation of these viewpoints is also important for Rod Dreher. He's a senior editor at the American Conservative magazine and website and has written a controversial book, The Benedict Option, which is mentioned in the play. Dreher is friends with Arbery's parents, and the 30-year-old playwright sent him the script.
Will has a great ear. He paid attention, and he has drawn art out of it. Reading these characters and reading their dialogue, I would get angry at some of them. I would sympathize with some of them, and I would identify with the dilemmas that they have.
The play takes its title from one of Steve Bannon's favorite books, The Fourth Turning. It describes four cycles or turnings in American history: high, awakening, unraveling, and crisis. That's where we are now, says the character Teresa.
That's the fourth turning. It's destruction. It's revolution. It's war. The nation almost doesn't survive. Great example is the Civil War and the economic crisis before that, or the Great Depression into World War II. And it's right now. the national identity crisis caused by Obama. Liberals think it's Trump. It's the fight to save civilization.
And in that fight, she asserts there are heroes and there are villains. But some of the other characters in Heroes of the Fourth Turning wonder if there is a middle ground. Director Danya Taymor says she takes hope from what she's heard at post-play discussions.
This play is a beginning because it is something that both sides are holding on to and are moved by. There's a great line in the play, can we hold two contradicting ideas in the same place and hold them there and know them both to be true? Like, is that possible, to sit with a contradiction, to live with a contradiction?
Playwright Will Arbery thinks that's the biggest question of all.
Let's say that we do engage with each other more than we have been and stop talking only to our side. And let's say that we do try to meet somewhere in the middle and listen and try to meet each other with grace and generosity. Well, then what? And like, what does it really look like? And is that sustainable? In a lot of ways, the middle ground is the most unthinkable of all.
For NPR News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
And in Australia, dozens of fires are burning out of control in New South Wales, the country's most populous state and home to the city of Sydney. At least 3 people have died and more than 100,000 homes are in danger. The conditions have sparked a debate about the role of climate change, as some government leaders deny a connection. Yesterday afternoon, I spoke with Amanda McKenzie, CEO of the Climate Council of Australia, an independent nonprofit group, and she called the fires unprecedented.
For instance, some of the fires are throwing embers 30 kilometres ahead of the fire. Mm. The fires are creating their own weather systems. We're calling them mega fires because they're so unpredictable and extreme in the nature of the fire behaviour. So this is climate change absolutely in front of our eyes at the moment, same way we've seen similar fires in California, mm-hmm. where firefighters are just not equipped to deal with them. And in Australia, we're seeing our bushfire season lengthen in most states. So it's now in New South Wales, for instance, it started in winter and it didn't end it last season until the end of autumn, start of winter. So there's just no time now for firefighters to do that hazard reduction burning in between. And in Australia, we share our firefighting resources between states. We share our firefighting resources with California. So it's becoming more and more challenging to fight fires when you can't necessarily share resources.
And you mentioned climate change. The Deputy Prime Minister, Michael McCormack, has said that only leftist lunatics are making the connection between these fires and climate change. How is this comment another example of perhaps Australia's current conservative government not taking climate change seriously?
Yes, well, the reality is if fires like this are burning that are so extreme, we're clearly not doing enough on climate change. And it's like a gun argument in America when there's a mass shooting, politicians that say, oh, this is about thoughts and prayers and we shouldn't talk about the root cause right now of gun control. In Australia, when there is major national disasters, often politicians will say, well, you know, thoughts and prayers, and we shouldn't talk about the root cause, climate change. Mm-hmm. So we're in that same scenario with some politicians in Australia, particularly the National Party, which is in the leading coalition party. But there has been a huge amount of pushback. So bushfire survivors, people who've had their house burnt down, for instance, there was a couple yesterday with their young child outside New South Wales Parliament pouring a bucket of rubble from their burnt down house saying this is climate change. So there's been some really powerful statements made from survivors. There's been a lot said from insurance. There's been a lot said from former fire authorities. So 23 former fire chiefs had warned the government multiple times that this season was going to be very bad and asked to meet the Prime Minister. It had been rejected. So that's become a big issue as well.
And how have the politicians reacted to all of this outcry from the public?
Yeah, well, the coalition government does say climate change has influenced these fires. They've moved to say that now. But what they've argued is you shouldn't talk about climate change while the bushfires are happening, that it's insensitive to victims. But what the former fire chiefs have said is, well, you absolutely need to talk about it now because people deserve to know why this is happening. Fire services need to understand what the risks are for the future, same with health services. Communities need to know that these are different sorts of fires that are very unpredictable and extreme, and that they may not be able to fight them. So we absolutely need to be having the conversation about climate change now. And in contrast to the federal government, many of the state governments and the local governments have been talking about it. So Carol Sparks, who's a mayor of Glen Innes, her house was damaged, her family was in hospital after the fire. She was out in the media saying, this is climate change, we need to take it seriously. I'm very concerned for my community. So there has been a real separation between the federal government and other levels of government.
Yeah. I mean, in speaking about the people who are impacted, it sounds very chaotic. It sounds very dangerous. I know that it's an evolving situation with these fires. Just give me a sense of where people are going, and perhaps if you're receiving help from other places outside of Australia.
So there has been help coming from states around Australia into New South Wales and Queensland. New Zealand has sent firefighters as well. We have some US resources in Australia that are contributing to the firefighting as well. And it's important to say too that this is still the early in the fire season in Australia. So what we generally see is the north of Australia fires start there first, and it gradually moves south as we move into summer. So we haven't started summer yet. That's the start of December for us. Mm-hmm. So we'd expect to see more fires in New South Wales, more in Victoria, and there are big population centres. And there's not expected to be significant rain till Christmas. So the situation isn't just live now, but the whole summer we're substantially unprepared for is the message that we've been saying. And we've been arguing that there needs to be a very serious meeting between emergency services to work out how we're going to deal with the summer, because we're not adequately prepared, as these fires are showing.
Amanda McKenzie is CEO of the Climate Council of Australia, talking with us about fires burning there right now. Amanda, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.